Penny Neal Smith's Yoga Weekend, Great Missenden, Saturday, 10th December, 1977. There are two psychologies. One is the psychology of the worldling. The other is the psychology of the yogi, or the perfected holy one. The transforming of the first into the second is yoga. The first is known by all men everywhere in the world, in some degree or other. We know what so-and-so is like, his character, his reactions, behavior patterns, and all that. That is the psychology which is investigated by our professional psychologist. And the attempt is made to put it into practice by the psychiatrist in order to heal the sick psyche. And then, if the patient is supposed to be healed, he is recirculated into a world which is of such a nature that it is the source of the sick psyche. The second is known fully only by the perfect yogi. But it can be glimpsed more and more clearly by the devotee of the religious life who has grown sufficiently in order to be free of much, at least, of the sickness of the psyche of the worldling. Yoga, therefore, the practical aspect, is essentially the discipline of the psyche. And this discipline, when come to fruition, releases pure mind, which functions freely through a psyche that offers no resistance whatsoever to this unknown and unknowable transcendent energy. The living person we call a psychophysical organism. To use the Sanskrit term, nama rupa, translated in various ways, all of which are inadequate. Nama, name, rupa, form or shape. Name, form. Mind, body. But the word name is used not merely in the sense of a person's name being John or Mary or whatever it is, but in the Aristotelian sense of the informing principle. And this sense was prevalent in Europe right until the Middle Ages. After that, it began to disappear. Now, instead of looking at it in the limited form of body, mind, or name form, let us regard it in a fuller and a truer form, which will be very much less misleading. Regard it as mentality corporeality. It's very important to do this. Universal mind energy, pure mind I'm talking of, universal mind energy interacting with body, a finite pattern, a limited finite pattern of universal corporeality, or matter if you like to use that term, produces psyche, a particular pattern of universal mind, which is formless and shapeless in itself. Therefore, you or I, the living person, is a psychophysical organism in the particular, finite, limited, and therefore mortal sense. Corporeality, mentality, or pure mind and pure matter, which are both expressions of primordial, transcendent, creative power or energy, which is always the unknown and unknowable. Because all knowing implies the reduction of the transcendent, the immortal, the immeasurable, inconceivable, unimaginable, to the level of the finite, the particular, that which will be born and that which will die. So, it is quite correct to talk of one's own psyche, because when universal mind interacts with the body and gives rise to psyche, psyche is rooted in the brain and nervous system and ductless glands, your genes and your hormones, etc., particularly. So the roots of the psyche are actually material, physical. Physical in the sense of the word as derived from the Greek physis, meaning nature. Now, nature brings the physical organism, the physical organism, to physical maturity, to allow the psyche, note carefully, to allow the psyche to grow healthily and to come to maturity is our personal responsibility. Nature hands over that task to us. And as and when the psyche comes to full fruition, to maturity, to the well state, the completely healthy state, then psyche is identical with pure mind, this creative energy. You know the good old Greek myth of Psyche and Eros. Study it very carefully in the light of these remarks, and you will find some very interesting things emerge. So now, allowing the psyche to grow healthily and realizing maturity, which is our personal responsibility, is the task of yoga. And you will see, therefore, that yoga actually is identical with all the deep aspects of the religious disciplines in the world. Truly religious disciplines, not the fringe religions and the lunatic fringe in the regions. Now you might say, why do you say these things so authoritatively? I have no authority whatsoever in myself. But let me put before you something which you will find in the Hermetic teachings, ancient Egyptian teachings, presented in their Hellenistic forms, in the three volumes which are titled Thrice Greatest Hermes. Talking of creation, God is referred to as the mind, the light in that work. And there is this sentence, and God the mind, being both male and female, as life and light subsisting, brought forth the world. And it goes on to say, but all father mind, notice the terminology, all father mind, being life and light, did bring forth man co-equal to himself, with whom he fell in love as being his own child, for he was beautiful beyond compare, the living likeness of his sire. In very truth, God fell in love with his own form. Remember, the archetypal form, not this form. In love with his own form, and on him did bestow all his own formations. Now that sentence gives us something of a vision of what you and I are intended to be. That potentiality lies in every single creature on this earth belonging to the human kingdom. Let me read you something from the Gita. Sri Krishna speaks, by me, the formless, all this world is pervaded. All beings have root in me. I am not rooted in them. Nor have beings root in me. Behold my sovereign yoga, the support of beings, yet not rooted in beings. The Supreme Spirit, which is mine, their efficient cause. You see the paradox there. And in this sense, the word yoga means mystery. And again, Sri Krishna says to Arjuna, of course, I am life immortal and also death. And again, all-consuming death am I, and the source of all things to come. It is teachings like this which give us something of a vision of what yoga is about, what living the religious life means. It means the total human life, not excluding what we call the worldly life at all, but it means so to live that we do flower out into our full and true humanness, and then naturally, spontaneously express it in our everyday life and in our everyday consciousness, which offers no resistance whatsoever to transcendence manifesting itself as perfected man. Man co-equal to All Father Mind, who created in the divine sphere the conceptual likeness of man. It's very difficult to understand these things merely with the exercise of the brain. And we will see something of the reason why it is so difficult. Consider, therefore, the worldling. I am a worldling in some degree or other. What is the worldling like? An imperfect creature, bodily and psychically. Second, he is confused, fearful, violent, sorrowing, the slave of his desires and his pleasure drive. He is conditioned by natural evolution and by his socio-cultural heritage. He functions ambivalently, dualistically, and is the maker and perpetuator of the ill state. These are very hard things to say, but if we are truly concerned with yoga, our concern is truth, not what is the pleasant, which we want to possess and keep, not with the unpleasant, which we want to run away from or get rid of. It's truth that matters. Why is he the maker and perpetuator of the ill state? Because he is isolatively self-conscious. Consider the waking state. What occupies the central point position in our waking state? I, myself. If you just watch your own thought process for 2 minutes, 120 seconds, you will find the word I crop up probably 240 times. And you will find that the entire process is one in which you are constantly drawing to yourself, wanting, possessing. You are frightened of this. You want to do this, you want to do that. Watch your fantasies, watch your thought process. And this little I occupies the central position. And all the rest of the universe, and think of the proportion, just this little person here called I and the rest of the universe is you, the not self. Who is conceited? You see? Therefore, being isolatively self-conscious, and since there are 4,000 millions of us on the globe who are isolatively self-conscious, in that same manner, therefore, there is conflict between man and man and within man himself, perpetually. This consciousness, this awareness in terms of I, the self, and all the rest as the not-self, is the root source of conflict. And as long as that is there, what is called I will always be in the ill state, in the subhuman state, not in the truly human state. Man, who was created by All-Father Mind, you can add to that what is said in Genesis, the first chapter, the 26th verse. And Elohim said, Elohim is the name which is translated as God, and Elohim said, let us create man in our own living likeness. You'll notice that I've slightly altered the conventional translation. And God said, let us make man in our own image. Those words are somewhat misleading. But let us create man in our own living likeness. So now, being isolatively self-conscious, he is dominated by this separate entity, I, consciousness. That is why he is not an integral whole. He is not in relationship with the world. He functions in terms of images which he sets up in his brain, which is the concretest expression of mind, of images of himself, images of everybody else. And it is these images which interplay and interact all the time. And therefore, he is not an expression of one of the other great meanings of yoga, that is, restored into communion, constant and total communion with the whole, with the totality, the one total reality that there is. He is out of communion. He has, each individual has excommunicated himself, in fact. And yoga means to be restored back to that communion. The worldling can grow into the true human. He can become flower into the true yogi, the perfected holy one. The knowledge of the worldling's psychology, as you will see now, is an imperfect psychology and often a misleading knowledge. Now consider the yogi, the holy one. He is Purusha, as we say in India, Sanskrit, Purusha, which is translated as person. He is the person. Now what does Purusha really mean? In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, in the very first chapter, you have a very revealing sentence. It's very easy to pass over it as you read the Upanishad. It starts off, that little paragraph starts off by saying, in the beginning, there was the Atma, that means the ultimate reality only, whatever that may be. There was the ultimate reality only, in the form of a person, Purusha Vida. And then it goes on to say that formally, which is rather an absurd term to use in the context, formally, which of which the Sanskrit word is purva, purva, formally, he burnt out, and the root, so the Sanskrit root of burnt, the word burnt, is ush, to burn up. He burnt up all evil-mindedness, sarvam, all papmanam, mindedness. He burnt out all evil-mindedness. Therefore, he is called the Purusha, the Supreme Person, the Supreme Being, as we might say in English. So you see, there is the sort of vision of what man really is. And the word human, again you've got man in it, the root man, meaning pure mind, the creative energy which creates everything, including the human species. And the prefix hu, which is interchangeable with su in Sanskrit, hu in the Avestan language, means good in the sense of the transcendent good, which neither you nor I know or understand. When we go right beyond all the dualities, and we can be aware in terms of wholeness, complete wholeness, then we naturally are that transcendent good. So, man means to create, not just to think. The verb to think, in Sanskrit manyate, doesn't mean just a string of words going through your brain. It means a creative activity. When pure mind functions through you, it is not a string of words which goes through the brain, because those are merely dead images floating past, but it is an actual power which brings into being the totality, the universe. If in Genesis, first chapter, it had been written, and God minded, let there be light, and there was light, you too will see light. And if you can mind anything in that way, the Logos, the word, the creative word, if you can mind anything that way, it is there. Can I do that? Can you do that? So you see where we are. Not yet fully human. Man, the co-equal with God. So the Holy One is, the yogi is like that. In whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. He is the enlightened one, the clear-sighted one. He is free of all images, therefore, of self or not-self, and so on. Completely open-minded. He is non-dependent. He is wholly interrelated and interactive with totality. There is no self-obtrusiveness whatsoever in him, and therefore he is the alone, to use Patanjali's word at the end of his yoga aphorisms, Kevala, the alone. But note the meaning of the alone. It does not mean the lonely. It means the one only. But the one only is the totality, the entire cosmos. It is one with the creative power that is the whole cosmos. These are things which really go beyond conceptual thinking. You have to feel this with your heart, meaning not feel it emotionally, aesthetically, or with the penetration of a brilliant brain which stands apart from truth. You have to be that truth. Then you understand it. And it is yoga to be the truth like that, to be that alone, the one only, even as transcendence is the one only, means that yoga is manifest through you. That person, the Holy One, is fully awake, unself-conscious. He is totally attentive. He is completely unconditioned. Therefore, he is whole, free, healthy, immortal. Which doesn't mean that the physical organism as such will not die. Whatsoever is born will die. But death is a process of transformation, not of annihilation. It is a process of transformation in which identifiable, separate, particular entity does not remain identifiable, separate, particular entity. This is man clinging to his ego. He wants what he miscalls so terribly, I am I, to be made perpetual through time. But truth and reality, actuality, is in eternity, which is not continuous time. Eternity is something very different. Where does all this difference come as far as you and I are concerned? In our own mode of awareness, our own consciousness. We, being what we are, imperfect still, are conscious in these different modes. You take the so-called simple man, you take the primitive, you take the sophisticated city dweller, you take anybody and everybody. He is conscious of himself and the world in a manner which is different from the way in which everybody else is conscious. It is in the manner in which you are conscious or aware which expresses whether you are the full human or at different grades of development from the subhuman state to the fully human state. Now, yoga then as a teaching is the teaching of yogis. And perhaps we are beginning to see, just get a glimpse of what it means to be a true yogi. One in whom all evil-mindedness has been burnt out. One through whom pure mind, the mind of God, if you like, to use that term, functions freely and without hindrance. One other thing we might consider for a minute. It is said that when the Buddha attained enlightenment, for 7 days he stared at the roots of the tree under which he sat. You might say a strange thing to do. The bright-brained man of the world would say, what nonsense is all this? The perfected Holy One, the enlightened one, even if he has botanical interests, is he going to stand motionless for 7 days and stare at the roots of a tree? What is this tree? This is what has so far not really been expounded or revealed. You might perhaps guess what it is now. This tree is your own brain and nervous system. In the Gita, Krishna talks of the Ashwatha tree, which all our bright scholars have identified as the ficus religiosa. You can forget the ficus religiosa. This is the Ashwatha tree with roots above. The brain is the root. The stem goes downward, the main trunk, and the nerves go out that way, branching downwards. This is the Ashwatha tree. He stares at that. Why does he stare at that? That is just a symbolical way of saying this. In him, the psyche had become completely purified. He was the perfected yogi. And what sort of a psyche is it, which is the utterly purified psyche? Totally empty of all the concepts, beliefs, images, the store of memories, experiences, the subhuman reactivity to the entire life process, all that is out. There is something which is transcendentally alight, enlightened. Light, alight with the creative fire which never scorches, but spells perfect life for you. This is what he looked at. This is what he really had become. And this is something which cannot be put into words easily. And therefore, he had to consider very carefully how he could present the teaching of the way to the fruition of perfect manhood, which is identical with perfect godhood. Don't forget that. Jesus at the end of his life acknowledges, and that's why he was crucified. He was a perfect yogi too. He acknowledges when he was asked, are you the son of the blessed? The Jews wouldn't pronounce the sacred name Yahweh. They always said Adonai, or they said the son of the blessed one. Are you the son of the blessed? And he says, I am. Not I, Jesus, a separate human being, but the one and only I am. The cosmic awareness functioning freely through each individual as and when he has perfected himself. and for that they crucified him. Now, all this makes it imperatively necessary for us to set our sights. If we mean yoga in the true sense, to set our sights on nothing less than transcendence. By the same token, nothing more than transcendence. Transcendence is transcendence. It's the immeasurable, the non-descript. You might say, how do I set my sights on transcendence then? I have nothing to see. Look at the form in which we put it. I have nothing to see, as if I am looking at something outside myself. But if, without being self-preoccupied, in the petty, selfish sense of the word, I look within, and I can truly see within, not analytically merely, but be fully aware of the withinness, then the barrier between the withinness and the withoutness disappears. The barrier between what we commonly call the conscious mind and the unconscious mind, and both are slightly, somewhat misleading terms, disappears. There is only the unified mind, the one and only mind of the world functioning through you freely. Just as the matter composing this physical body, solid, liquid, gaseous, is part and parcel of the one universal matter, which in actual fact is interconvertible with the one universal energy. An energy as pure energy we don't know at all. We know the different forms of energy, electricity, or chemical energy, gravitational energy, the different forms. We know all the secondary, they may be tertiary grades for all we know. But the thing in itself, here and now, as limited organisms, functioning and communicating with other limited organisms, we can never know that. So don't try to grasp that. Therefore, what can you know? What can you understand? What can you deal with? The secret is just this. Pure mindfulness every moment of the day. Pure attentiveness to every single stimulus that comes to you from what we commonly call the outside, and every reaction from the brain which goes outside. The whole task of the yogi is what people would ordinarily call the negative aspect. It's like this. Supposing a room is full of cobwebs and dust and so forth. Have you got a bottle in your cupboard labeled cleanness? You can't take that bottle and sprinkle it in the room and have the room clean. The dust and the cobwebs will still be there. Get rid of the dust and the cobwebs, and the room is clean. You are transcendence embodied. You can't acquire it. And the finite cannot acquire and hold the infinite. You see? Therefore, to be wide awake to all that is actually present, to be totally attentive to it, means freedom from all images which clutter up the mind, all self-seeking, drawing unto oneself. That is the truly important part of yoga. Now it has its preliminary aspects, what are called the yamas and the niyamas, the moralities and the religious observances. Then it has that middle grade. Well, it's not exactly in the middle. You can't get an exact middle out of 8. 4.5 perhaps. You see, then that middle grade, the asanas and pranayama. But the asanas as such are a keep fit system. Is there any keep fit system in the world which is truly the fruition of man created in the living likeness of the Supreme? It is a keep fit system. Consider why you take to the keep fit system. Because you want something. But this is the denial. This is the denial of yoga. I want to be free of this trouble, that trouble. I've got 7 pimples on my nose and they make me look so awful. I'd like to look beautiful and attractive and wonderful. I'd like to succeed in the world. I'd like this, I want that. How many times have I used the word I there? Now you see the implications. What is the special value of the asanas and then later on the pranayama? What is their special value? It is a bodily discipline like many keep fit systems. It is a bodily discipline by means of which you are able to be free of the intrusion by the body upon your attentiveness, your mindfulness, when you are in the meditative state. That is its real purpose. You know from your own experience, you say, oh, I'm going to meditate. You don't actually, you merely muse in your mind, here, there and everywhere. You go through a verbal ritual. We don't know what meditation really means. The truly meditative state is that state of communion which is the creative state. That's the full meaning of the meditative state. That is samadhi, you see. But if you sit down, just let the body be quiet and calm, then what happens in that calmness, that quietness? You go through a happy state, a relatively happy state, and you think you're meditating. But you will find that, especially in the beginning, quite unexpectedly, all sorts of bodily disturbances will crop up. You'll start coughing, you'll start sneezing, you'll feel an itch here or there, and of course the tummy will make the biggest possible noise it can to disturb your orisons, your meditations. Now, the asanas certainly are a means by which this you can be free of this. But you see the purpose. It is to prepare the organism to enter the meditative state more easily, with little obstruction from the body, if any at all. Until your discipline enables you to reach that state, whereby you can sit for 7 days and nights continuously in meditation. The Buddha says this quite openly, for 7 days and nights, without a stop, I can be in that state. A supreme communion. You find the great Christian mystics talking of these things. Read Saint Teresa, for instance. Read Angela de Foligno, Elena von Krevelsheim, and others. You see? And you will find that this is actually the fact. This is possible. So that's the purpose of the asanas. The pranayama, be very careful, is a playing with fire. Pranayama must be very assiduously associated with the preliminaries, the yamas and the niyamas. The watchfulness over your own reactions. As you see any state arising within you, violent or fearful, or whatever it may be, just see it for what it is. See it exactly. And in seeing it exactly is the healing of it. No psychologist, no psychiatrist will really heal you of your psychical disease. He will help you to counteract it. He will help to tranquilize you. To give you palliatives and so forth. But those do not affect any healing. Whole making is a totally different thing from counteractive and tranquilizing, which are all dopes. Just be strong, stand on your own feet, and say to all tranquilizers and dopes and such illusory things, out you demons. And they will go. They are very nice people, the demons. They teach you a lot. They teach you more than the angels or anything else. The angels are awful seducers, because you see, they are very pleasant and nice. And that's what I like. Then I can smarm myself, self again. So you have to be very, very careful about all that. Now, pranayama is the link which enables the purified organism, the body, purified as far as its nervous vitality and strength is concerned, purified with respect to all its states, its moods and so forth, which will allow dormant energies, tremendous energies, which are your own potentiality, to begin to function, to begin to operate. And this is where the supreme aspect of yoga comes in. We come to the other four elements: pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. Usually they are just mentioned in a string and nothing further is said about it. It's difficult to say anything about it. Pratyahara is translated, and I would almost say mistranslated, as nothing to do with the objects of sense. To withdraw your attention from the objects of sense. No one can live in the world by withdrawing his attention completely from the objects of sense. The objects of sense are our teachers. The senses, in fact, are our cords of communion. This is very important. You see? So, The real meaning of pratyahara is this. As the senses function, because you are attending to your whole life process, beware of being attached to what you like, of being repelled by what you dislike. Free from attachment, free from aversion towards anything and everything. That is the real meaning of pratyahara. And when that is possible, then you will discover something quite extraordinary. For the first time within you will stir compassion. Love in its transcendent reality will begin to function freely through you. Think. No attachment, no aversion. Your acceptance of totality is natural, spontaneous, and complete. Is that love? Isn't it love? In its true sense, do you and I know this ordinarily? Look into this deeply. And then you will have true compassion. And if you have such true compassion, you will also have true wisdom. You will know precisely what to do in any situation, in any circumstance, towards anybody and everybody, towards anything or any event or any situation. This is one of the wonderful results of pratyahara. And then what's happening? There is dharana. Dharana has been translated, even the Upanishads and the Yoga Upanishads do not give away the entire secret. Well, no one can give away the entire secret. But the heart of the matter is this. Dharana means an upholding. It's derived from the root dhri, meaning to uphold. What is it that you uphold? You look carefully into your own psychical process, your function. You uphold this against that, because this is better, nobler, truer. I'm a virtuous person if I uphold this. I'm a vicious person if I'm not against that. But just try and feel it for a moment. You are God. You are transcendence. Creator and upholder of the totality does transcendence reject any part of totality? Does it take sides? So, what you are upholding is what we call Ritta. Ritta is the eternal order of the whole cosmos. This is what you are upholding. And now, in that state, the psychophysical organism is extremely sensitive to transcendental archetypal forms of the one of energy, of expressing the one total primordial creative energy. It expresses itself in various ways, and the ways in which it expresses itself are embodied in the religious teachings of the world, in the names of the archangels, the gods as they call them in other lands, and the angels, the constructive and the transformative or disruptive forces of the world, and so on and so on. Look deeply into their meanings. One could talk for a couple of hours about all that, but we must go on. So it is that eternal order of things that you uphold. You are, to use the commoner garden religious phrase so misunderstood, doing God's work. But don't deceive yourself. Be free of all self-deception. I am doing God's work. There are any number of stupid people all over the world who suffer from that delusion. God minds his business through you. God knows his business. You don't know his business. You know your business. To be conscious in such a manner, to be attentive in such a manner, that there is no rejection, there is no attachment, no aversion anywhere. You see, that is yoga. Sri Krishna said, yoga is skill in action. And skill in action does not merely mean skill in writing a symphony or cooking a first-class dinner or anything. This is transcendent action in eternity of the universal process. You become sensitive to that. That is why asanas and pranayama have to be very, very rightly approached and carefully understood. Then the organism won't break down under the strain of those transcendent energies. You see? And finally, the dhyana, which is not a meditation which is set apart for 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock, but which is a constant process. Continuously you are attentive. You know that verse in the Bible? Not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. And of course, how we do misunderstand that sentence. But that is the kind of thing that happens. It has to be understood symbolically. And so, one is in the state of complete communion always. And that is the fruition, the perfection of the yogic life, which has to go on continuously. It is not like attaining something. Just as the blood has to be flowing all your lifetime, their brain has to be working, your heart has to be beating, otherwise the organism dies. So too, the yogic life is the total life. Thank you.
Bruce, I've discovered that in my 3 o'clock meditation practice, after meditating for half an hour, 1 hour, I become what I just call peaceful, as opposed to my normal condition. But I can't seem to penetrate beyond that initial peacefulness to a deeper state of consciousness. Is another practice required, or should one just continue meditating in the same way?
Why do you want to penetrate into a deeper state of consciousness? Isn't that a self-seeking?
Yes, that's what it
is. Well, there is your first lesson to start with. Observe what you're doing. This is seeking for the self. This is the result at root of a pleasure drive. And the whole world is caught up in this mad, sometimes criminal, in its process and its results, activity. Which is the pleasure drive at work. So be careful. Observe what happens. Just observe. Be neither attached nor feel aversion to it. Just see very clearly. And if you can be totally aware of what is happening, the next stage will emerge by itself. After you were born, how did that body grow? Because you said, now it shall grow this way, it shall be 6 feet 2 inches tall, it shall be this, that and the other. You couldn't do anything of the sort. There was a transcendent energy which we call the life energy. We don't know what it means or what it is. Your body, like Topsy, just growed up. And if you had any sense and your parents and those around you had good sense, they would have just allowed it to grow up, just being on the lookout for what prevents the growing up. And then, lo and behold, you grow up as you. It's precisely the same with the psyche. That is why I said, I laid emphasis on that, to allow the psyche to come to fruition by being very observant of all your reactions, all your desires, which are just images raised up by the imperfect person.
Not having an aversion or an attachment. I can perhaps understand the not having an attachment to, in the way perhaps that you meant it. But when you speak of not having an aversion, do you mean that we must see things that we hate and repel us, which we're human and we do hate certain things? I don't mean people. Do you mean then that we must see it and not do anything about it or try to alter it when you say no aversion?
When aversion arises and you see it is rooted in hate, aversion is rooted in hate, you see this is hate, and you know that hate is not exactly something which promotes healthy growth, which prevents maturity. It's the worm inside the apple, which may look very pretty on the outside, but it is being eaten. When you really see that, the hate disappears. When you really see it, when you're really totally aware of it, the hate disappears. And then there is only compassion and true wisdom present.
Even compassion for the things that you dislike.
Of course. I mean, why should I dislike anything?
Cruelty, for instance.
All right. I say this man is horribly cruel, and I dislike him. But somebody else may be desperately in love with that man. How does he view that cruelty? These are all views. These are all partial awarenesses. You see, we have to grow into the state of whole awareness. People have used this phrase very lightly and easily without knowing what they are talking about. Cosmic consciousness. But when one is completely free of all that, of all hateful reaction, disliking this, etc., then, because of the presence of compassion and wisdom, you do the rightest possible thing that a person can do in the situation. Otherwise you can't. Similarly with attachment, we destroy ourselves and that around us both ways, through attachment as well as through aversion. Look at the way parents ruin the lives of their children through attachment. Oh, my child must do this, must do that, must become like this, must become like that, until finally one day there comes the catastrophe. You see, these things go very, very deep.
What about evil?
What is evil? You tell me.
such things as other people being utterly crushed.
Who crushes them but myself?
No, other people crush them.
Where does the sense of otherness come from? Who is it that is possessed of the sense of otherness? I am not doing this, it's the other fellow who is doing it. Am I my brother's keeper or not? Am I responsible? Partly responsible, not wholly responsible, of course. No finite thing can be wholly responsible, which is an infinite responsibility.
But if other people suffer.
Exactly. What is it that you observe then? You observe the phenomenon of cruelty, of something which you may rightly call evil taking place, you see. You observe that phenomenon and you have nothing to do with it yourself. But you don't condemn. You cannot condemn the other person. You cannot say, as so many have said, if you really go deep enough, hate the evil, not the evil doer. But if there is no agent of evil doing, namely the evil doer, there is no evil. In hating the evil abstractly like that, you are just divesting the total situation from the personal element. That is all you are doing. The mind is playing tricks. Remember what Jesus said, neither do I condemn thee. Go thou and sin no more. He was a great yogi, remember. And a great mystic. The theological world doesn't like that sort of statement, that Jesus was either a mystic or a yogi. See, the inquisitors who burnt people at the stake in order to save their souls. Study that very, very deeply. Go very deeply into it all and see how it has functioned. The yogi never disclaims responsibility for everything that happens in the universe, because we are in actual fact completely interrelated. When you make a decision at home, oh, I think I'll do this. Are you the sole person responsible for that decision? Has not husband or father or child or friend or anything made suggestions, etc.? And from how many sources do all these influences come and finally precipitate in a particular action? Who is responsible? You see, we must never disclaim responsibility for anything and everything everywhere in the universe. Because by doing that, I cut myself off from the world and say, oh no, I am not part and parcel of you. But nature's fact, it's nature's fact which nobody can deny. I am part and parcel of the totality. Do you think this would subsist for a single fraction of a second if the not-self disappeared? If air, heat, light, sun, earth, all disappeared, where would this be? Non-existent. You see, we must sort of look with open eyes, unblinkered eyes, and the psychical eye The mental eye has to be one which has no blind spot at all in it, like the physical eye has. All yogis or students of yoga have heard the phrase, the third eye. What is this third eye, the divine eye? Don't say it is situated at the back of your head there and associate it with what is the ductus gland? Pituitary, yes. It's not the pituitary. You can associate it with that symbolically, but that's all. You see, the third eye. The third eye which can see without light. Darkness and light as a duality mean nothing to the third eye. You know that marvelous statement which Hinduism has. There was a yogi who was practicing such tremendous austerities and developing such tremendous powers that the gods in heaven prayed Vishnu, the second person of the Trinity, to save them. So Vishnu said, "All right, I'll see what I can do." And he went down to this person and said, made his salutations to him and said, "May I ask a boon from you?" And the yogi said, "Yes, ask." "Let me just take 3 steps." And the yogi said, "All right, take 3 steps. He was not, he hadn't really made the grade of perfect yogi. So he said, "Yes, take the 3 steps. The first step covered all earth. The second step covered all heaven. Where shall I take my 3rd step, said Vishnu. And he suddenly blazed forth in his full effulgence, a word which the Hindus are very fond of using. You see? And the yogi said, "My Lord, here on my head." And so Vishnu stepped on his head and plunged him into the earth, the primordial source from whence he came, thereby giving him another chance. No annihilation. So that is another way of saying that with 2 steps you cover heaven and earth, and your 3rd step is in, not on, the void plenum, which is the totality. It's the state of consciousness, the state of the supreme communion, samadhi. Look, who taught me, or you, or anybody in the world, to suckle his mother's breast the moment he was born? It happens naturally and spontaneously from within. Who teaches me to see with my eyes? If there is a defect in the eye itself, and if my eyes do not function at all, I can't see. No one can teach me all the functions of life. Life is a mystery. I can learn a particular skill, a particular know-how, a particular technique which concerns the routine processes of material existence. But no one can teach me to be in the meditative state. Can anybody teach you how to fall in love?
You can be inspired. You can be inspired. Maybe you can be taught, but you can be inspired by your teacher.
You can be stimulated. But a stimulator is not a teacher in the ordinary sense of the word teacher. We can all be learners, every one of us. We can be self-professed learners. And if we do learn from any one person, then by our act of learning, we confer teacherhood upon the other person. But no one, if he is sufficiently sensible, should be a self-professed teacher. Look at the number of gurus that plague America, for example. They live in palaces. Where do the yogis live? In nice little huts. With one window and a low entrance. With nothing there. Poverty, chastity, obedience. These are the teachings, if you like, of the great teachers. What the teachers experienced, what they realized themselves, they communicated to their earnest aspirants. But to teach you to be in the divine state, in the transcendent state, the state of complete and utter communion, just cannot be done. Yes.
Try to meditate. And I think that you have to be among spiritual people, or people who you feel spiritual, to encourage you to meditate. Therefore, I think you do need some sort of guidance.
It's not a question of you need it. If the aspiration is natural, if it is a thing which you just cannot help because you are like that, you see, if you are like that, that influence emanating from you draws the presence of another person who himself inspires. You see, he is not teaching you, but there is a natural interaction. It is like two people who love each other in the real sense of the term. Whether it be father and son, man and wife, friend and friend, teacher, schoolmaster and brilliant pupil.
Do you agree that is a help?
Of course it is a help. It is also a hindrance. As and when you become reliant upon that person. You see, you have to stand on your own feet. Look, in the days when I used to teach people to play the piano, this was in the old, far off days, I used to tell them outright, I'll measure my success as your piano teacher by the speed with which you cease to need me to teach. If I have to teach you year after year, I have failed. But if in a week's time you can say, there you are, I'm off, bye-bye, I shall be delighted.
There is a little confusion in my mind about the part played by the asanas. By doing the asana.
Asanas, yes.
If you ask the majority of people who go to yoga classes, they would go there for a keep fit purpose, to be healthier, to get rid of their spots. Somehow, in my mind, I am not going to try to disappoint them. Because if they are more beautiful with their body, if their skin is clearer, if their intestine works better, because that's the purpose of practicing the physical side of yoga, they are going to be better persons in any case. They are going to be more open to the rest of the world. So it's going to reflect outwards somehow. It doesn't mean that these people are going to be inclined to meditation. Because another confusion in my mind is, why is there so few people who meditate? And so many people who very sincerely practice their asanas.
Look at this question carefully. Forget the discipline of the asanas for the moment. Take all the people who pursue, keep fit systems, you see, in order to be well and strong and so forth. They achieve fitness of body. What do they do with the fit body? Greater self-indulgence to start with. A stronger drive to fulfill their own ambitions. Both their conscious ambitions as well as their secret hidden desires. Look into the whole story as it unravels itself. It's like a Shakespeare tragedy. It really is. What do I do with the fit body? Look at the conceit it gives me. Oh, I did my keep fit systems. I live on a perfect nature cure diet. And look at me, fit and strong and so forth. Look at that fellow suffering from this, suffering from that. Serve him right. No wonder he's like that, because He doesn't do anything to keep fit. He eats the wrong thing, drinks 5 bottles of whiskey every day, and all that sort of thing. Well, look at the conceit and the hatefulness in my inner being towards the misdoer. You see? So you have to beware of all that. There are tremendous hidden dangers in realizing what in our dualistic, ambivalent state we call good, as against evil. As long as the two are at war with each other, there is perpetual trouble. So that's why the fundamental basis of the moralities has to be there to start with.
Well, thank you for giving me an answer to
that
question.
That's one aspect of it.
Yes, it is.
One aspect of it. Side by side with the purification and the betterment of the body must go the development of the psyche in terms of the moralities. That is the absolute basis. And then the rest will gradually emerge. And if there is constant mindfulness, constant watchfulness, not taking sides with this against that, then as your dormant powers, which are all hidden within the living organism, gradually begin to function, they won't destroy you or hurt your environment. You know, if you read so many of these Hindu texts and Buddhist texts too, you will find how often the yogi falls to the ground. And the greater the yogi he is, the worse is the ill consequence. Because always in life there will come a circumstance so provocative that unless there is the complete purification from within, the utter unselfing of the self, you see, unless that is there, that provocative circumstance will make you sin more terribly than the worst of sinners. This is the point which people don't take into account. They are so anxious to achieve, to attain, to gain, all the rest of it. What am I achieving or attaining? This person was born on such and such a date and he'll die on such and such a date. After living 70, 80, 90, 100 years, time and again plaguing the environment in which he is, you see, and then, like the autumn leaf, falls to the ground. But the autumn leaf falls with such exquisite dancing grace. Do I end like that?
Had Christ, the Supreme One, no aversion to Satan?
No aversion to Satan?
Yes. You know, coming back again to this, which is all really bearing on this, is the questions, most of them anyway, about this not having an aversion. What if the, if I may ask
Look.
You this, Christ, who to most of us, or to many of us, is the supreme epitome of,
yes,
of grace and goodness.
The Christian...
Would he have had no aversion to the symbol, if you like?
The Christian world as a whole does not know the meaning of Satan. Does not know it. When Jesus dipped the piece of bread and gave it to Judas, you see, and then it is said that Satan entered into him. Study it very, very carefully, especially in relationship to the original Kabbalah from which all these teachings are derived, you see. Then Satan entered into him, and Jesus said to him openly that what thou hast to do, do it quickly. With the implication also, do it well. You see? Now, Satan represents that energy which brings to a catastrophic end that which has become settled and fixed. The crucifixion of Jesus brought the catastrophic end to the fixations of Judaic religion and form, the external form. People don't see that. Judas was the son of doom, if you like. You see, but would the Son of God have triumphed ultimately without the Son of Doom? Go into this very deeply. Did Jesus reject Judas? Not at all. You see, Jesus himself could not bring about this catastrophic event in relationship to himself, although he annoyed the Jews very much. They picked up stones to throw at him and they couldn't do anything with him. He did this, he did the other, but it couldn't happen. It had to happen through another agency. And who picked Judas but Jesus himself? You see, these are terrible things to say. The Orthodox Christian world would naturally rebel frightfully against all this. But that can't be helped. One doesn't worry about such things. You see, water flows off a duck's back without troubling the duck.
Well, in fact, it's said in some of the lost books of Eden that Christ actually said thank you to Satan after his temptation in the wilderness for having increased his wisdom.